I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. In this episode, I'm talking to Laura Lex about her commercial novel, Pivot. Laura is an award-winning comedian, actor and writer who lives in Brighton with her husband and her Jack Russell Mackie. In this episode, we discuss why she chose not to describe her character's appearances, how stand-up comedy makes a good partner to writing funny books, and how her writing career began with a tweet that went viral. But first, here's Laura with an excerpt from Pivot.
The sea was not expecting to be hit full force with a golf club. To be fair to Jackie, though, she hadn't been expecting to throw it either. Well, technically at the point where she was standing on the beach staring at the sea and holding a golf club with the encouraging words of Roz in her ear, by then she was half expecting to throw it. But not really. Jackie wasn't the golf club throwing type. She'd barely ever looked at these golf clubs before Roz had loaded them into the boot. They were long and heavier than she'd expected. Didn't golf last all day? Golf lasts for hours, she said absently to Roz. How the hell do you lug these around all day without dying? Caddies, said Roz, looking up from removing furry covers from the lumpy clubs. Is that them? Jackie nodded at the little golf sock things. No, these are... Do you know, I don't know what these are. Some sort of warmers? Why would you want the clubs to be warm? I don't know. Maybe it makes the ball go further. So what's a golf caddy? Jackie shook her head, losing their thread. This was a common side effect of talking to Rose. It's the person who carries your clubs around for you so you don't get tired. Like a servant. Lord, no wonder it's so popular with men. Someone else doing the hard work while you swan around pretending you're the dog's bollocks. Jackie launched another iron hard out to sea and heard the splash as the lengthy pole slapped the surface of the dark water. The lights of Brighton stretched out along the coast and she felt tears pricking at the corner of her eyes again. Have you ever played? She asked Roz, determined to keep talking rather than crying. Was this really happening?
Hi, Laura. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you here with me today to discuss your novel, Pivot.
Ah, thanks for having me.
So can you start by introducing the novel for us and telling us what Pivot's all about?
So Pivot is about Jackie Douglas, a woman who thinks she has it all. She's completely happy with her life. And then one day her husband walks out on her and everything feels a whole lot emptier than it did before. She finds herself retired, so there's no job to fill her day. Her children are grown up and happy and don't need her as intrinsically as they did before. And she suddenly goes, oh, what are my hobbies? And in a roundabout way, ends up starting a netball team.
As you do.
Yeah, you know, we've all done it. We've all been a bit bored of a Tuesday and started a netball team.
So what was it that inspired you or gave you the idea for this novel? Was it one specific thing or did it come from kind of wanting to tell a particular story?
It came from a real mixture of things. So one was wanting to write a book about a whole group of women. And I was trying to think of a way to get a lot of women into a plot without it being a workplace or that they'd all had babies and so met via that. And I was sort of looking around and thinking, well, there's a million and one things about men playing sport, and that's how they've all met. So why not do it for women? And then at a sort of similar-ish time, I'm a stand-up comedian is my main job. I was hosting a show and there was a whole group of women in there who were on a netball social. And I just started improvising about how much I hate netball. You know, going back all over all the half-baked rules I could remember and the different, like, oh, a chest pass and a bounce pass and you can only hold it for 3 seconds and you can't pivot. And it went down so well in the room that I took it home and sort of wrote it up and thought, I wonder if this is a thing, this like nostalgia for netball. So that sort of maybe inspired like, oh, sport, a team, that could really work. And then I sort of ended up, you're sort of daydreaming about characters and they sort of, I don't know, to me, they sort of drift in. And I was sort of thinking like, what sort of women might be lonely and looking for something else? And then I tried to think of sort of all the different versions of your life where it's gone a little bit off track. You're not super miserable in, you know, the end of the world, but you're missing something and why you might seek out companionship.
Mm. And obviously Jackie and most of her friends are older women. How did you feel about kind of, because she's an early retiree, how did you feel about kind of writing an older character or older characters without that kind of awkward stereotype of, you know, you're writing them as elderly or you're writing them as too old? How does it feel to kind of approach writing women that are older than you and be able to write them authentically?
I hope I have done it authentically. I based a sort of a fair amount of it on my mum and friends of my mum's. My mum's about Jackie's age. But also I sort of thought, well, I'm 36 now and I think when I was 20, I thought 36-year-olds were very different to how I feel now. So I sort of took that approach with thinking about the way Jackie thought and felt, that I think one day I'm just going to wake up and be 58 and feel the same as I do at 36 and the same as I did at 20. So I sort of tried to write her sort of without leaning too hard into the fact that she's a lot older. She is at a different space, but I think that is going to happen to everybody, you know, like I tried to think of it as age isn't something that has happened to old people and no one else. It's all of us. We're all on our way there, hopefully. So,
yeah, it struck me that quite unusual to read a book where it felt like authentic, like someone writing old characters, but they didn't feel like you'd suddenly imagined them as grey haired with a stoop. You know, it was like you'd really thought about how can I make them like a real 58-year-old and someone who, because I think Jackie's the sort of character that she doesn't feel 58. She's not inside her. I think if you asked her, she'd probably think, you know, partly would be, I don't know, in her 30s. And I feel like when I've read books where characters been in her 60s and I've thought of my mum who's in her early 60s, you know, my mum's pretty cool and she would shop at, you know, Zara and places. She wouldn't be, you know, she wouldn't be necessarily in M&S looking at a twin set.
Exactly the same. Like my mum still works. She would do all sorts of long walks together, like miles and miles and miles. She is terrible with her phone and how that works and all technology, but she's not doddering about. She's early 60s. It's not this catapulting into geriatric level. And the same with, like, my dad's a bit older. My dad, we've just celebrated his 70th. And the man still plays 90 minutes of football every week, like with people who are my age. So I think like this idea that the age you've got tells you anything about the character is a little bit broken, you know. So I sort of didn't really see there being a barrier to writing an imagining of an older version of myself or things like that. And I hope for readers who are closer to that age, they weren't sort of turning every page going, oh, this is a young person screwing up this imagining. I wanted her to, you know, like, I don't know, for me, like early 60s, you've still you know, fingers crossed, got 30 years of your life left. You're not done. You're right in the middle of it. You're busy. You've got stuff to do. But it for Jackie anyway, is this transition phase. Which come throughout your whole life, I think, and sort of writing in the other characters who were also in those transition phases.
And I read an interview with you where you said it was a really conscious decision not to describe your characters' looks or their bodies, and you instead focused on their feelings and maybe the way they felt about themselves. So can you explain why you made that decision?
Yeah, it's two-pronged, that one. One, I don't have a very good visual imagination. I think in words. I don't picture images very well. My imagination is often the spellings of words. So it's not to say I don't understand what you mean. You say she's blonde and 6'8". I kind of get it, but I'm not picturing anything. I'm just sort of putting that information in a list in case it's useful later. So it's partly that. And then it was the other half of it was, I mean, maybe I'm just a bad writer, but I'd sit down and I'd be like trying to describe Jackie. And in my head, Jackie's like, I think she's maybe blonde. She looks a little bit like my mother-in-law, I think, in my head. She's got blue eyes. So then I was sort of like, right, okay, how do you describe that? You know, she's got fluffy blonde hair, or blonde highlights, or and then, okay, leave that, let's do the eyes. She's got sparkling blue eyes. Well, maybe they're not sparkling, maybe they're just blue eyes. And then it was just becoming this list of, this is a blonde woman with blue eyes and she weighs 10 stone 2, because I don't want to say, oh, she's fat or she's skinny, because that is a judgment call. Like, she has some body fat. So at that point, what are you doing with this description? So I just thought, does it matter what she looks like? Can we all just picture who we're starting to build up as our own thing? And I'll just let you run wild with it, because it was either just going to be this functional list of attributes that was barely, what was that for? Or it was going to turn into these judgment calls about what kind of blue eyes, or like, I don't know if I've ever read about a female character with green eyes without going, she's the baddie, yeah, she's going to steal someone's mind, she's got green eyes, that's what they do. And so it, you know, it just falls into these what women are, and I didn't want to do it.
I sometimes find that if you're reading something and then there's almost like a breakaway paragraph or a couple of lines where it's almost like the writer's gone, right, at this point I have to describe how they look. And I'm always a bit like, oh, I'm never very keen. Or you get someone that looking in a shop window or in a mirror purposefully, just so that the author can describe what they look like. And it's always a little bit clunky. And I've always been a bit like, I don't really want to necessarily say what they look like. But I have had editors before that have gone, I think you need to put, you know, they've got brown hair or something.
Yeah.
But how do you, if you say that you don't necessarily write or think about things visually, what's that like for you, kind of just describing anything, even if it's like a house or landscape or anything? Is that something you feel like you have to go back afterwards and add details in? What is that like for you?
I think so. Like, for Jackie's house, the image I have of that in my head is a friend of my mum's house that seems to me like the epitome of a suburban detached house. So I sort of have that in my head, and so there were descriptions of things like that that I was like, oh, I think that tells you something about the way she lives, like the kitchen being spotless, or they've got powder blue sofas, or there's the little lead diamonds on the windows. Like, it's building up a sense of who and where she lives, and no one has to know that I'm picturing a house around the corner from mum and dad's house. But I find a lot of the time when I'm reading books, I imagine where it is and I'm sort of starting to think about it. And then if the writer contradicts me, I just go, no, you've got that wrong. And I can't then alter where I've put them. Mm. So I think it made it less important to me to describe the layout of the house or how everybody went. But things like, so, you know, she goes to a netball tryout in the sports centre, and things like the glaring lights or that like foamy green flooring, or the long wooden benches, that felt like it was atmospheric to me rather than functional physical description, because it's that, you know, when you walk into one of those sports centres and the ceiling's so high and you just feel, oh, I do anyway, I feel so small and useless and like this is not my natural habitat. So it was more about reminding the reader of all the things that might make one feel uncomfortable in that space, rather than going, here you go, here's the painting of it so that you can play with the puppets on it.
I guess then when you're, and I guess that's a bit of advice really, when you're describing a setting or a location, there has to be a reason you're doing it. It's got to be because your character's interacting with it or feeling some way about it. And I think, like you say, when you're reading a book, you do end up building this picture in your mind, even if the author hasn't given you any real descriptions. I'm exactly the same as you. I think I've read books before where I'm picturing, I don't know, the love interest as a, you know, tall, dark and handsome, and then they turn around and say they're blondes. I'm like, what? No,
yeah, blonde. Because if you don't fancy a blonde or whatever, then you're like, oh, no, I'm less interested in this character. I can totally understand it for books like, you know, if you're writing a thriller, maybe you need to describe the room because you're leaving clues to where the murder weapon was hidden or whatever. But yeah, I felt like for this book, it's so much more about the people. That they are just front and center, and how Jackie's feeling about everything was way more important.
Yeah, because your book does deal with some kind of emotional topics. Obviously, we meet Jackie, and it's quite a funny situation, the fact that she's throwing golf clubs into the sea, but the reason behind it is obviously a very painful one for her. And because you are a stand-up comedian, what is that like? Do you feel like a pressure to write a particularly funny book? And do you feel like it's kind of more challenging than writing a stand-up routine? How has it been for you to kind of have that pressure of, I don't know, being funny on the page compared to doing a stand-up?
It was quite nice, really, because you write in different forms in a book. Stand-up very much has its own rhythm, and each comedian has their own rhythm and their own voice. And so you hit a point where you're like, I'd love to talk about X or Y, but are there enough gigs where there's an audience that wants to hear about that? And, you know, if you've got a 20-minute stand-up set, you ideally need to have a punchline, you know, maximum every 30 seconds for me, I think. Like, I don't like to do big setups. I'm not like a big wind-up for a 4-minute story and then have a payoff. So writing a book let me be more gently funny, or just play with a collaboration of words that I thought was amusing but wasn't enough of a laugh out loud gag that you could take it to people on a Saturday night and go, here you go, it was worth you getting a babysitter and, you know, bothering to come out. And playing with sort of funny ideas, just the idea of two women stood on the beach in the dark throwing golf clubs into the sea. I wouldn't really be able to tell that as a story, like a hypothetical story on stage, and you need more context. And the book allowed me to kind of develop these real bigger things and longer sentences, and stand-up has all, you know, when you're telling a joke, the last word you say in the sentence needs to be the last thing the audience need to complete the picture and then to laugh. And if you've still got more words to say, you're talking over the laughter that they're doing, whereas a book you could be more melodic and play a lot more, I think.
So do you think that comedy and writing kind of make a good companion? Because I know obviously your style of stand-up is observational humor, and you do storytelling within that. So do you think they make a kind of good pairing?
Yeah, I liked doing the two of them together, because also I don't know if I could have written a book without the release of stand-up, because a book needs, you just don't get any feedback for so long. It's so scary. You, like with stand-up, even if I'm working on a new special or something, I take that chunk by chunk out to audiences. I test it out. We see how that goes. It goes in the hour. Then I try out the hour for a year or so, then we record it, then I put it out, and that's the release. But actually, I already know it's good at that point, otherwise it wouldn't have gone in the show. But the book, oh my life, I just sat by myself and wrote it, showed it to one editor who either liked it or didn't like it, and we adjusted, and then we printed loads of them and just put them in shops. And there was no sense of like, well, if the audience come back and they don't like X, we'll adjust it so that it's better. You just, and that is so alien as a stand up. It was that was so hard to get no feedback. I hated that.
And are you someone that reads real reviews? Because obviously when you're on stage, you're getting that instant feedback. But because you're not getting it writing a book, do you go and seek out feedback or not?
No, I haven't really. Because I think I know I like it. And I think I know what kind of book it is. I know what criticisms people might have. People that were looking for a weighty tome about weighty things are going to think it's a bit fluffy. Fine, it is a bit fluffy. I wanted to write a book that was a bit fluffy. People that, you know, so I think I know what the book is. And I think it's a good version of what I wanted the book to be. And I think any negative reviews of it will go to my heart. But they will be reviews from people who wanted a different book. I don't think if you picked up that book wanting a story of female friendship that was a bit funny and nostalgic for netball, you would go, this wasn't it. So I take reviews too seriously and too much to heart. And I like the book and I think it's a good I think it is what I set out to write. So there's no point in going and looking for that upsetting feedback just to hurt myself.
Mm. And like you said, it's done now. It's out in the world.
What can you do?
Yeah, exactly. So obviously, as you mentioned, friendship is such an important part of this novel when not only just Jack and Roz, but also the friends they make on the team. Obviously, some books that would fit in this genre would be maybe leaning towards the romance side. That's not to say there isn't any romance in this book. What was it about friendship that you wanted to focus on?
I didn't want the answer to Jackie to be replacing Steve or that there'd been anything wrong with their relationship. Their relationship had been what she wanted. And it had run its course and it was done. And I wanted the idea that your friends are maybe a little bit more than society allows them to be a lot of the time. You know, we have this idea that our partner and our family, it's blood and it's marriage and it's pew, pew, pew. But actually, I think for a lot of people, your friends are and can be everything. And so if you fall out with them, the hurt is as big there as it is in a marriage or in a sistership or whatever. And I sort of wanted to look at the ways you can hurt each other without meaning to, or how you prioritize the people around you who are helping you when you're broken. You know, sometimes you are your worst friend when other people are trying to be a good friend to you because, you know, maybe you get a bit selfish when you're broken sometimes. And how do you come back from that? And how do you bounce back? So, yeah, I wanted it to be this idea that friendships are really, really complicated and can be as complicated as a sexual relationship, but that's not really what I mean, but like a romantic relationship, you know, like a life partner relationship.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So we've got to talk about the netball, because obviously that makes a big part of the novel. And so, I mean, you mentioned nostalgia. Was that the reason why you went and chose netball? And how did you go about writing it? Because I noticed in your acknowledgements, you thanked a couple of your friends that kind of dragged you in for a game. So tell us about the writing of the netball. Did you have to do, I'm imagining you had to do a hell of a lot of research and hands-on research, I'm guessing.
Well, yeah, I did go down. I played once, I think, with my friends, and I really hated it. I didn't do it again. I went down and watched a couple more times to just get the idea of what these leagues were like. Because the thing about netball is, for me, it's a game I learned at school, and I've not really thought about it until about 5-7 years ago. A load of my friends started playing it on a Tuesday night down at the local university courts, and I couldn't join in because being a stand-up evenings when I work, but they loved it, and some of them stopped playing, and some of them carried on, and then they formed their own team, but then they would jump across into other people's teams if they were short, and then they'd switch to the Sunday league, which was the next up league or whatever. And then when netball had sort of crashed into my life again via the stand-up routine that I was working on, I started looking into it, and it was crazy to me how popular netball is. The viewing figures for televised netball have never been higher, and they grow year on year.
Wow.
And the Super League, I think that's what it's called, like Australia, New Zealand, a lot of the Commonwealth countries, they play it, and the viewing figures are very high. England are one of the best, well, it might be GB, I'm not sure. But they're one of the best netball teams in the world, and it gets nothing. And then I started thinking about it from a stand-up perspective. I'd started writing a lot of material about how netball is one of the biggest problems. I have a joke and a routine about how netball is the start of the gender pay gap, because the boys get taken one way and get taught football, and it is the beginning of this lifelong opening up of a world where football is everywhere, and it, you know, it's an icebreaker, it's a job, it's a passion, it's everything. And the girls get shunted the other way and given netball, which we struggle to learn for 10 years. And then we leave school and it's not playing in the local pub. It's not on that we can go and see locally. It's not something that you can sit down in your job interviewing. Oh, who do you support? Oh, yeah, me too. Like, so we just don't get given that. And there's no reason for that. We could have been taught football. We could have had those doors opened up to us. So it felt kind of like netball is this perfect thing that they don't really like, but they like each other. Mm. And I wanted it to be this sense of like, it's not the activity that's keeping them coming back. It's each other, and it's this need, and it's this hour a week where you are your body and you are running hard and your chest is busy and your brain is busy and you are something other than a mother or a retiree or a stuck millennial who can't work out how they've gone so wrong already at 30. You are trying to reach as far as you can for the ball. And having chatted to my friends that play netball, they were like, yeah, netball is this switch off. It's so fast and it's so difficult that it's all I'm doing for that hour. I just get an hour where I'm not thinking about tomorrow. And it was like, yeah, that's what I wanted to give the characters.
Mm, and it works so well, like you say, in that moment, it's all about the game and there's no external worries about what's going on in their personal lives or their professional lives. and you can see why it's such an appeal for them.
Yeah.
Later on in the novel, one of your characters is diagnosed with a condition called encephalitis, which you said was inspired by your mum's experience. So can you tell us a little bit about that and why you wanted to raise awareness of this condition?
Yeah, so my mum had it in 2010 and it was awful. It came out of nowhere as far as we were concerned, and it just knocked us all for six, especially her, and then has been a really difficult and non-linear recovery. And I chatted to mum about it, because I've not really seen it come up in much stuff, you know, and when you're thinking, what's a thing that my character can have that can cause a problem? You're like, a stroke or heart disease or, you know, all these different things. And then I was thinking, right, okay, I don't really have much connection to those. I don't know about them. And I'm quite a sensitive person. I don't want to get that wrong, because that is a lot of people's lives. So I sort of talked to mum about using the encephalitis, and she said yes, like, more people should know that that's on the cards, more people should know that that's a thing and what the symptoms are. So we talked about using it, and I think it's a condition that it really can affect your thinking patterns afterwards, which for somebody like, you know, the character Roz, who is so clever and fast and busy and just loves to be challenged, loves to think quickly, talk quickly, answer back, to have your ability to reach for information and have it just out of grasp is so frustrating. And I've watched it with mum. She's so smart, she's so clever and quick and at things like that, and then she'll go to, you know, we'll be in a quiz or something, and they'll say, which band, blah blah blah, and mum knows, and she knows, and we know she knows, and the word is gone. And I know that that happens to everyone, but I think the recovery from encephalitis just made that so frequent and so much wider ranging. And it's such a hard thing to reconcile with yourself, that your mind isn't as organized as it used to be. And I think, like, a little light on that where you can could be helpful for other people who still have that to come in their future, or have been through it.
And I think there's so many things like that that we don't see in fiction, so it's refreshing to see it. And I think because it touches on your sense of self and your identity, and you mentioned, you know, Roz is this really ambitious and smart woman, and then to have something like that happen to her just completely knocks her sense of self and her confidence.
It's frustrating. I think, well, we've all been through different versions of it. Like, I think, you know, I'm smart and capable. And then in 2017, had a complete nervous breakdown and ended up on antidepressants and in therapy and struggling to carry on. And that knocked me. I was like, I don't need pills to carry on with my life. And then I sort of had to go, actually, you do. You do. And that's okay. It doesn't make you less. It doesn't make you any less good on stage. Or, you know, one of the things I fought against was taking antidepressants, because I was like, I'm on stage every night trying to do quick comebacks, and what if they dull me? What if I can't reach that? Or, you know, X, Y, and Z. And I really struggled to conceive children, and that knocked my identity for six. I come from a massive family where everybody's got four kids and I couldn't make one. And it was like, whoa, so who am I then if I'm not going to be this mumsy sort of, I was so ready to do that. So I think these like bashes to who you thought you were just smash you at all times. Like, you know, Jay in the story, she's 30 odd, she's clever, she's been to university, she did really well, she walked out, got a job, moved to London, it was all going well, and then there's been recession after recession and nightmare economics, and suddenly she's back in her mum's spare room going, oh, was I not very good at it then? Because the story we get told is that if you're good enough, you'll make it, and actually not necessarily if everything in the world has conspired to be a financial shit show, apologies for swearing. You know, there's a lot of our generation that have ended up worse off than our parents have, and going, oh, hang on. And it knocks you, it knocks this idea of who you are. You have to really fight to come back from that and go, nope, who I am is what I do when it goes wrong. Not, I wasn't only ever going to be this winning version of myself.
Mm-hmm. And as painful as all those things are, they make for great conflict in a novel.
Yeah.
So although this is your debut novel, listeners might also know you from a tweet that went viral and then a book that came from that about Jurgen Klopp. And I will confess right now that I know nothing about football.
Oh, me neither.
So can you tell us a little bit about this story of how you went viral and then how that became a book?
Yeah, it's very silly. So it was March of 2020 and it was the week before the first lockdown in the UK. I was up in Glasgow doing a weekend of shows, but I don't know if you remember that weekend. Everything felt so weird. Other countries were shutting down. We weren't yet, and there'd been no real announcement that we might. You couldn't get hand sanitizer for love nor money, and masks weren't really widely available yet. And I found myself in Glasgow. I'd got the sleeper train up. It had been awful. I'd done the first night. There was a strange atmosphere in the club. Like, it was a sold out night, but about a third of people hadn't come. A lot of us were there going, should we be here? Is this like a spreading event? We just didn't know. So I sat in my hotel room that night and I happened to see a clip of a press conference from a football manager where somebody said, what do you think about all this coronavirus then? What's going to happen? And he said, I don't know. Why are you asking me? I'm a football manager. Ask somebody that knows the answer instead of asking me to speculate and turning that into headlines or something along those lines. And I just thought, who is this dude? This is the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. Nobody says I don't know anymore. They just answer and then... So I started doing these tweets about how sensible he was. And so they ended up being these sort of tweets where it was, you know, the idea being I'd be silly and anxious and then he'd be sensible and then we'd kiss. and it turned into a bit of a thread. And then I think I went to bed that Friday night and just sort of didn't really think much of it. And then I woke up Saturday morning and again, I thought, I'll just stay in my hotel room today. I think that's my best bet of not catching whatever this disease is that's coming around. So I carried on tweeting. And I think because the internet that day was panic or cheerful, sexy tweets about a sensible man, it just went wild. And I've had stuff go viral before and I sort of thought, oh, you know, you get a day of lots of retweets and then it dies down. But this sort of didn't. And a few authors like Emma Kennedy and Marianne Keyes were saying, oh, you have to write this as a book. And lots of people saying, oh, yeah, I'd buy it. And then so some publishers and literary agents started getting in touch. And again, I just sort of thought, well, I don't know. Well, it's just some tweets. I don't know. And then, you know, got home and the lockdown kicked in and they were serious about doing this book. And to be perfectly honest, I didn't have any other income because of stand-up just being wiped out overnight. And I thought, all right, I'll take these meetings and take it a bit seriously. And then it feels a bit like a fairy tale, but they sort of said, oh, well, you're clearly a writer. If you write the Klopp book, would you like a deal for a novel as well? And so I just sort of went overnight from this, well, not overnight because of the years of stand-up and all of that, but yeah, they sort of said, if you write the Klopp book first and we try to turn it around as quickly as possible and then, hey, have a deal, what novel do you want to write? It's an open blank page, go. And it was kind of magical.
Yeah, it's kind of the dream, really.
Yeah, like now that I'm trying to get a third novel off the ground, I'm like, oh, I had it really easy.
I mean, it also shows how many people had this fantasy about Jurgen Klopp that you weren't, well, none of us were aware of until your tweet went viral.
Yeah, absolutely. Like that unusual crush. I would never say guilty crush because I think it's really rude to the person you're crushing on. There's nothing guilty about fancying anybody, but this like love of sensibleness rather than rippling muscles or objectifying, you're sort of praising their behavior rather than their being. I think, yeah, we all were finding that a bit of a turn on.
So despite the fact that it didn't start with you thinking, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to approach agents, Had you kind of always secretly had this dream of writing a novel anyway?
Yeah, and I've written one before that's unpublished that nobody wanted, and always written lots of longer form stuff alongside the stand-up. Yeah, massively. So writing a book was just a dream come true, and I hope to do more and more of it. It's so wonderful having that time with the characters. But yeah, I think a few years ago, maybe about 2014-ish, I finished my first story or first novel and did try and get that published, but you know, absolutely no response, not a return at all. So this was a very different experience. And like I say, now got a literary agent and got a publisher and trying to get the idea away for the next novel, and they're suddenly really choosy and you're like, oh come on, can't you just do what you did before? Just say, yeah, write what you like. This is annoying. They want you to write the whole book before they say yes to it. And you're like, hang on a minute, this is a lot of work.
But you have another project on the side, which is also about writing, which is something you started in lockdown. And you kind of, it's almost like a virtual game of consequences, which is a game that I always loved as a kid. And what you would do, you'd use the start of a novel that you'd already written, I think, and then you got viewers on, it was on YouTube I think, or on Twitter, yeah. And you got viewers to help you write the next chapter by voting on various different things, which is a concept I love, and I think you've just resurrected it, am I right?
Yeah, I have. So yeah, we did a couple in the first lockdown. I read on YouTube, I read that book that never got published, As We Know It. I just read it live on YouTube, and we do a few chapters each night. And it built up this really lovely following that all sort of made friends and everybody was chatting. And then when I finished the book, I was like, oh, I haven't got another book to read you. Sorry. But I thought, oh, I've got endless time though. So we wrote this book to spec basically. And we did two of those in the lockdown where I write a chapter, I give a vote. It might just be, you know, does the character find the thing they were looking for? Or sometimes it's like, who do they meet in the next bit? And sometimes the consequences will be really obvious and sometimes they're a bit more mysterious. So I'll give some options and then I sort of sketch out an idea and then see which wins. And then it was so lovely through the lockdowns to do that, that when the news sort of broke about how high energy prices are going to be and how much food is going up and how difficult this winter is going to be, I thought maybe we could do it again through this winter, because it's free but for the price of your internet connection and the electricity to run your computer. Just turn up on a Tuesday night, 9 p.m. If you can't make the live one, you know, you can catch up with it through the week. They all sit there. And the chat is just so busy while the story goes on that quite a few people turn up for the chat room element and then rewatch it later on because they've missed half the plot. But it's sort of fun and it's silly. And as a writer, it's a lovely exercise because I know my weakness is plot. I love to write all the prose and the description and the characters, but I'm not great at building the plot. So it's lovely to have that taken off my list because it depends what they vote for. So
do you think it's helped your writing or process or your ideas generation when you have to sit down and write novels yourself?
Yes, it's made me think about chapters as more like tools. So you go, what's this chapter for? You're not just living with some characters over a period of time. Things are happening. Each chapter is got to have a reason, what goes on in it. And it's made me be a bit more adventurous with plot. I'm quite tend towards naturalism, and that can make it a bit boring sometimes because I avoid being too OTT. But actually, as a reader, to a certain extent, you want a little bit of fantasy in this plot. You don't want to just read a story about a woman having a normal week. You want a bit more to it. So it's made me be a bit braver in that.
So is there anything that you know now that you're a published author that you wish you had known right at the beginning before you began writing?
You're always going to feel like a fraud, no matter how you do it. So there is absolutely no point in reading other people's advice on writing. You just, however you do it, if it results in something people want to read, then it's writing. Well done. I felt so like I was a dreadful person because when I wrote both the books, I would write for about 45 minutes a day. And then I was bored and I would wander off and do something else. And I was like, how could you possibly think you're a writer if you don't long to be there at the page for 8 hours every day? You should want to do this. And you know, I'd read tweets from people with kids and stuff who were like, I just wish I had more time to get on with it. And I'd be like, I've got all the time in the world and I want to watch TV and go for a walk and do sewing. But that's okay. I write really well for 45 minutes and then I wander off and do something else. And I would come up with the same amount and quality if I stretched it over 8 hours as I can bang out. And that's okay. I think that, like, this gatekeeping idea of what it is that I don't know if other people are even doing. I think we do it to ourselves.
Yeah.
But shed that.
It's the comparing thing. I think you're right. And I know I cannot write longer than 3 hours. 3 hours would be my absolute maximum, and it would probably be an hour and a half of me sitting there going, I hate this, why am I doing this rather than doing something else. But 3 hours, I mean, anyone that sits there at nine and can write for, I don't know, 4 hours, 5 hours, who are they? I don't understand them. So there's no point me trying.
No, if it's not you, it's not you. I think me and my husband have a really different approach to stuff. I am electric for a short space of time and I get a lot done, have really good ideas, and then I'm done. I fizzle. Whereas he takes about an hour to warm into the project and then can sit with the utmost focus for hours. But we kind of come out with about a similar quality. He warms up. It's like a slow rotary wind up, and then he's in and he's focused and he's deliberating. Whereas I'm more of a sprinter, like quick dash, and then I'll mull it all day and I'll go, oh, that's an idea, note that down, but then I'll come back to it the next day. I think, like, get rid of any of this romantic idea of writing that it's ever going to be like, I've got the perfect desk now and I'm writing this book, so I'll clear my diary for 6 months and I shall write the novel. That wasn't my experience, but it's still turned into a book.
And finally, are you able to tell us if you're working on anything new at the moment?
At the moment, not book-wise at the moment, I'm working on a new stand-up show that is coming for spring 2023. So that's kind of, I haven't done an hour stand-up show since 2019. So I wanted to flip back that way for a bit.
And I guess that takes up all of your creative energy.
Well, you'd think that, but then the second I signed the thing and said, yes, I'll do three nights trying out this new show, obviously book idea after book idea flits into your head because your brain is obtuse. But yeah, I kind of have to have one thing bubbling. I've got a notepad of ideas for other things that I'm like, well, write that down and come back to it another time. But yeah, sort of seeking out new material slots and trying to think of the structure and working out what you want to say, that is kind of all of my energy at the moment.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
That was Laura Lex talking about her commercial novel, Pivot, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.